You're listening to the 1632 Atari Podcast. The one with no hardware. Overview.
Welcome back to 1632 Atari Podcast. This is the one with no hardware, as there were no hardware shipped this quarter in the US or the UK. This is episode 12, and the dates covered are 1988 October through 1988 of December. And looking at my show notes, it appears that this is almost 3 years since I last posted an episode. So a long time coming.
News.
After Fujinet changed how I used the 8-bit Atari every day, I decided I needed to see what I could do to increase the usefulness of my ST. I looked for a way to connect to some ST BBSs, and what I ended up doing was landing on a Y modem 232, which is a Wi-Fi modem that connects to the RS-232 port. It was very reasonably priced, shipped and arrived very quickly, and I got it from CBM Stuff. Thanks, Jim, for the quick turnaround on this excellent product. There's a link in the show notes as well. We'll also talk a little bit about the Y modem 232 later. For making effective use of the Y modem 232, after several recommendations, I found that ANSI Term works excellently for displaying ANSI graphics in color on the ST and 80 columns. This little device has already changed how I use the ST, which is now daily. And that's a big change from how I used it over the last 3 to 4 years, which is long terms of just it being off. So now that I'm using it daily, it has sparked my interest in what else is out there, thus this new episode of 1632. And I have plans to do at least 2 more after this one. The next hardware I get will probably be a Net USB from Lotharic, which will allow some basic internet connectivity, and my goal is to find a way to print to my network laser printer, which fully emulates an Epson graphic printer. So if anybody has any ideas on how to accomplish that, and if Net USB is the answer, please let me know.
New releases.
So this time I found that LDW Power has been released. This is an advanced spreadsheet offering that has Lotus 1-2-3 compatibility, and it features 300 commands and 80 functions. It's $149.95, and today that's $338.46. Ouch! There's also ISD Marketing has released DynaCAD. This is 2D and true 3D CAD software. It supports the DXF file format, which is an industry standard. It has a full GIM interface, supports 256 layers and 9 zoom modes, allowing magnification up to 1 million times. It supports dimensioning, rotation, vector fonts, entity transformation, printer and plotter output. It requires 1 mega memory, 1 megabyte of disk drive space, and a monochrome monitor. And if you act now, you can get $150 off of the $695 retail price if you trade in your existing CAD software package. And at $695, that's $1,569 today. So one expensive piece of software.
Hardware.
All right, like I said, there's no computer hardware that was released at this time, so there is no hardware specs for at least one more episode due to release dates. My interim plan was to have these episodes filled with peripheral hardware, but alas, there was no peripheral hardware shipped this quarter either. So this time, I'm going to discuss the SX212 modem. This modem had Bell 103 and 212A standard compatibility. The modulation scheme is a four-level differential phase shift keying, DPSK, at 1200 BPS. It supports 75 to 300 baud, or 1200 BPS, that's bits per second, with auto negotiation. It supports odd, even, or no parity, character links of 5, 6, 7, or 8 bits, 1 or 2 stop bits, 0 or 1 start bits. It also supports full and half duplex, auto dial and auto answer, and it supports tone and pulse dialing. The modem has a built-in speaker with an adjustable volume, but you'll need a small flathead screwdriver to adjust it. The modem is Hayes command set compatible with a 40-character command buffer. And one unique feature, it has DB25 RS-232 port and an Atari 8-bit 13-pin SIO port. There's an RJ11C 4-pin port for the phone line. It's FCC registered as also being compatible with RJ11W, RJ12C, RJ13W, and RJ13C as well. This modem did not come with any software. On the ST, you can use the GEM VT52 emulator accessory as a terminal. And on the 8-bit, you can use SX Express by Keith Ledbetter as your terminal program. The modem did come with a 52-page manual. The case is gray and sized at 25 centimeters by 15 centimeters by 7.5 centimeters. The power switch is on the back, and the power required is 9 volts DC. The front has 8 LED indicators, all angled like the STXE styling. From left to right, those are HS for high speed, which is active at 1200 BPS, and that is the default. The next is AA for auto answer, and that's on when the modem is set to automatically answer. The next is CD for carrier detect, and that's on when you're connected to another modem. The next is off hook, and this is on when the modem is using the phone line. The next indicator is RD for receive data, and this flashes on as data is received. The next one is SD for send data, and this flashes on as data is sent. The next indicator is TR for terminal ready, and it's on when the terminal is ready to send or receive. And the last one is MR for modem ready, and this is on when the modem is turned on. This could have also been labeled power. The suggested retail price for this modem was $99.95, and today that's $225.60. So, wasn't exactly cheap. So I'm going to follow the SX212 with the Y modem as a comparison. The Y-Modem 232 is basically a DB25 connector with a Wi-Fi modem built onto it, and it plugs into your RS-232 port directly. It's fully Hayes command compatible. RX and TX, RTS and CTS, DTR and DSR, and DCD all are supported at the same time, which enables programs that need to answer and control flow, like a bulletin board system, to work completely well. It connects wirelessly to your network. You can even use the WPS feature if you have that enabled to make the connection easier. And setup, when I set it up, was rather simple, and I didn't use WPS. It requires a 5-volt power supply, typically supplied through a mini USB power plug, and I'm using one of the older white 1-inch square Apple ones. I'm also using that same type of plug on the Ultra Satan. The firmware can be updated through the internet and initiated by an AT command. And you can get the Y modem with and without a 128 by 64 pixel OLED display. Mine actually has it. The display gives you some useful information about connection to Wi-Fi and to whatever BBS you called. If you have a 3D printer, there is a file that you can use to print your own case. I have one of the cases, and the little connectors are quite finicky. I think they're designed to be done once. If you pull it apart, you'll have trouble keeping it together after that. I end up using one little dot of super glue at each corner, and it's holding together quite nicely. And as of this episode airing, the price is a reasonable $54.95. There's a link for it in the show notes.
Magazines.
All right, on to magazines. The only way I can do this is to not cover the reviews and on-disk programs, and for the most part, I'll skip those, only mentioning them if they are worthy in my mind. So we'll start out with ST User, Volume 3, Number 8, which is from October of 1988. This one is 108 pages, cover to cover. On the cover, it has Atari ST User in the upper left corner in an italic style font. The ST is in red, and Atari and User are in yellow, and there are two gray vertical bars backdropping the logo. A lot of the issues following this will match, so I won't cover those again. Down the left, it has fonts, F-O-N-T-Z, exclamation point, in blue, and music in red, reviews in green, and games in pink or purple color. And on the right side is a picture of a 520 ST with a Sony Trinitron KX-14CP1 monochrome monitor. And scattered about are various wooden stamps of letters and numbers in different fonts and sizes. I think the ST is an STFM model as it looks deeper than a 1040, but it's clearly marked as a 520. I also didn't realize Sony made monitors for the ST, and I'm guessing by the model number it's a 14-inch one. So the first thing I'll see here, there's an ad for the Atari Christmas show, and this has artwork of a blue robotic Pac-Man creature playing Space Invader type game, shooting down Santa. Oh no! This one is at the Alexandra Place in Wood Green, London on November 25th to 27th. Adult tickets are £4. Be there. You know, I don't know why we weren't seeing regular shows like this in the US, and it seems like we see these advertised all the time in these European magazines. The only ones that I remember in the US at this time were probably CES and Comdex. And in today's world, whatever happened to Comdex?
Comdex, an abbreviation of Computer Dealers Exhibition, was a computer expo trade show held in Las Vegas, Nevada, each November from 1979 to 2003. It was one of the largest computer trade shows in the world, usually second only to the German CeBIT, and one of the largest trade shows in any industry sector. Comdex exhibitions were held in many other countries from 1982 to 2005, with 185 shows altogether. The first Comdex was held in 1979 with 167 exhibitors and 3,904 attendees. In 1981, the first Comdex Spring was held in New York City. The show was sold in 1995 and traded hands a few times, eventually ending up under Key3 Media, a spin-off of Ziff Davis. The show appears to have stopped when Key3 Media went bankrupt around 2002.
All right, the first feature in this one is Ubisoft, The French Connection by Pam Turnbull. This is an overview, history, and future prospect of the Ubisoft software company. At this time, Ubisoft has been in operation for 2 years and is already expecting sales of $10 million. The next feature is Tools of the Trade by Andy Richards, and this is all about the STOS game creator. One interesting point I pulled away from this is that it took 2 years to develop the program, and it was a collaboration between Mandarin Software and JAWX, which is J-A-W-X. I think that's pronounced right, maybe not. The next feature is Grand Slam Bug Bites Back by Robin Nixon. This is an in-depth look at a relatively new software company called Grand Slam. The next feature is Gallery. This is a collection of digital art by Simon Smith of Fulham, London. And they all look interesting, but think seeing them on the screen would make them really pop out better. The next feature is Scrapbook. This is a couple of short programs sent in by readers. One is an assembly language program to cause the ST to boot off of drive B instead of A, and the other is an ST basic program to count words in a document. And here is one review that I'm going to mention. This one's called True to the Letter by David Davenport. This is a review of Fonts, F-O-N-T-Z, which is a gem-based font editor from Neocept. I mention this review because it's on the cover, and I have a fondness for character editing thanks to all the years of 8-bit usage, and I learned a bit from this article. Ever wonder exactly how big a point is when selecting a font size? You know, 12-point Arial, etc.? Well, this answers it. A point is the standard measurement used in typography and is 1/72 of an inch. The program seems to have all the standard functions I remember, like shifting, flipping, rotating, inversing, clearing, and filling. It also includes font scaling. So I think I'm going to look for this one and play with it. The last feature in this issue is called Better Safe Than Sorry by Francis Botto. And this is the benefits of preventative care and the consequences of care disregard in relation to your ST. There's some repair advice thrown in as well. The next issue of ST User is Volume 3, Number 9, and this is from November of 1988. It is 124 pages cover to cover. On the cover, on the left in a blue box with white text, it says Classroom Invader. On the right is a picture of two schoolboys hovering over an ST, which might be the same 520 STFM from the last cover, since the monitor looks like it might be the same as well, even though this is from a side profile view. The kids are wearing a red school uniforms, complete with the little hats. Think Angus Young from AC/DC. The first feature in this one is called The ST in Education by Nick Outerside. And this is an in-depth look at how the Atari ST made its way into the British classroom. And maybe this had something to do with the machine's popularity in the UK versus in the US. In that, I mean, if we had the STs in the school, maybe more people would have bought them at home. The next feature is Into the Third Dimension by Pam Turnbull. This is a description of a visit to Vector Graphics, the company that did the arcade conversions of Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back for the ST, and she has an extensive look at its history and its future plans. The next feature is Bursting Into the Protection Racket by Steve Baker. And this is a look at software protection techniques, command methods for subverting those protections, and some suggestions on alternatives that would be safer for honest users. Dongles, fake sectors, trick formatting are all discussed in detail, and one of the suggestions is around today in some form. That is, non-photocopyable card that has a code or a key on it that you must enter into the software itself. The next feature is called Off to See the Wizard by Niles Reynolds. This is a discussion about the game Shades, which is a kind of an early MMO game where you try to become a wizard. There are 16 games which can run concurrently, and the user base is over 6,000 at this point in time. In 1988, I only remember playing single-player online games on bulletin boards through doors, so MMOs would have been unknown to me at that point in time. So it's interesting to see that they're there. The next feature is the gallery, and this is, again, user-submitted digital art with the theme of a cat and the canary. There's a great picture of a parrot launching into flight, a black swan, a jaguar, a cat looking at a butterfly on a mushroom, and a few more. And the last feature is Fingers on the Button by Mike Baxter. This is a multiple-choice quiz game written in Fast Basic. And Fast Basic is still one I remember talking about before, and I still need to look at it in depth and play with it a little bit. The last ST User I cover this time is Volume 3, Number 10, which is December of 1988. It is 132 pages cover to cover. The cover is similar to the others now, and pictured is a surgeon donned in a green operating uniform, and he's working on an ST. The upper cover is removed, and he is using a scalpel and tweezers. And printed on the top of the magazine, white letters, it says, Computer Viruses, We Expose the Myth. So right away, I'm not sure if this is going to be a regular feature or not. I hadn't seen it in previous issues. There is a Gallup software chart, which lists the top 20 games, their price, when ST User reviewed it, any comments, their rank, and if they moved positions. Currently, Star Glider 2 sits at the top, followed by the recently introduced STOS Game Creator, which has moved up 11 to bump Super Hang-On from spot number 2. It doesn't say where the ranking data is from, and there is a full review of STOS in this issue as well. The first feature is Catch Them If You Can by Stephen Hill. This talks about the new threat of computer viruses, how they work, and provides a program to clear bytes 32 to 512 from the boot sector of disks, which is supposed to free an infected disk of a virus. Oh, and stay away from public domain software, as that's where you're most likely going to catch one. The next feature is the gallery. This is, again, user-submitted digital art. There are pictures of Santa's elves, prepping gifts, a candle by an open book, Madonna from the True Blue album cover, which is a great picture, by the way, a guy being shocked between two Tesla coils, think his skeleton is visible, and one of some fairies in the woods, and one of a dancing gesture. You know, one of the things I notice about these galleries is that some of these pictures look pretty darn photorealistic, and I can't help but think they're either scans or they are pictures that are somebody's taken and digitizing. The next feature is The Tender Years by Nick Outerside, and this looks at the use of the ST in education, why the ST is better than the BBC Micro, and what software they use. And the last feature we'll talk about in this issue is Top Secret by Julie Boswell. This is a utility that wipes a file's contents, then deletes it so it can't be properly recovered. And unlike today's wipes, this one places ASCII 32, or space, in every byte, whereas today's usually place an ASCII 0, or sometimes a 1, or sometimes a 0, then a 1, if I remember correctly. It's presented in three flavors of BASIC, Fast BASIC, ST BASIC, and GFA BASIC. The next magazine we'll cover is ST Log, and we'll start with issue number 24, which is October of 1988. This one is 101 pages cover to cover. On the cover is a white background with the ST logo in gray. At the top in black letters, it says Special Games Issue. Pictured is a clown juggling six rainbow-colored balls while jumping on a trampoline that is being held by two blue monkeys. There's also a small hot air balloon at the top right corner. The image is captioned with presenting Monkeys and Balloons. The first feature is Monkeys and Balloons by Regent Software, and this is written by Frank Cohen. This is essentially a review and a promo for the game. I know I've talked about Frank and Regent Software in the past as well. The next feature is the 1988 Summer CES Show by Arthur Leuenberger. This time, he says, CES feels like it was different this time, and Atari only exhibited games. 1987 saw almost $1 billion spent on video games. It says in here that Activision changed its name to Mediagenic, as it better represents its role as an umbrella corporation for company lines of Activision, GameStar, Infocom, and Rainbird. I'd never heard that before. The next feature is a tutorial. This is Software Engineering, and the title is More Tools of the Trade by Carl E. Weigers. This is a continuation of previous article on software development, this time focusing on data flow diagrams. The next feature is a programming feature, and this is The Writing of Opus by Doug Harrison. Here he explains some of the source code and programming techniques used for the previous month's type-in spreadsheet, Opus, which was almost 10,000 lines of code. Okay, so maybe it wasn't a type-in, but a disk distribution. The next feature is Ancient Part 1, A Guide to Dungeon Master by Bob Rattel. This is an overview of the game Dungeon Master and tips for starting a new game, building a party, and surviving in the game. For those that may not be aware, a party is a D&D, or Dungeons & Dragons term, for a group of characters. The next feature is Two Futures by David Silvestri. This talks about the need for video games to change over time, unlike, say, board games, like how releasing a remake or a copy of a 3 to 5 year old game will not be sufficient. There's also a brief look into where gaming might go, like VCR games. It also includes some predictions for different periods of time, and let's just say 2010 plus was a bit fuzzy. I think we went through that up until the mid-2000s, and now rehashing the same style game seems to be the norm, with a lot of duplicity in the market. But he was right about the VCR games, and something that he couldn't have foreseen, DVD games. The next feature is programming. This is Assembly Line, Numbers Part 1 by Douglas Weir. This is an assembly language primer on multiplying and converting numbers on the 68000. And the last feature we'll cover here is Seamanship. This is Desk Accessories and Built-in Resource Trees by Clayton Walnum. and this takes a look at creating desk accessories, specifically converting the time setter previously discussed in the last issue. The next issue is ST Log number 25, November of 1988. This one is 100 pages cover to cover. The ST logo is in yellow and red here, and the backdrop is a picture of two elves, or miniature Santas, at a workbench. One is working on a model airplane, the other, who is wearing stemless black reading glasses, is working on a computer. The computer is futuristic in design with 10 whole keys. The monitor has a label that you can just make out that it's an Atari. Behind the elves is a fireplace, and over the mantle is the lower portion of a picture of Santa, and the frame has a placard on it that reads, Chief. The first feature in this one is an editorial by Clayton Walnum, and this has a bit of a scandal in it. The private Atari dealers are concerned about what Atari is doing with the Federated stores. If you remember right, Atari owned Federated. It seems the Federated stores are able to keep 1040 ST stock, whereas the private dealers can't get any. Neil Harris, the Federated stores manager, said it was due to high stocking early on and low sales because they were not up to speed on selling them. I agree, stinks of a cover-up. The next feature is Ultragraph by Blake Arnold and Phil Mast. This is an on-disk program that does 2D and 3D graphic, and it's written in GFA Basic. The next feature is Software Engineering by Carl Weigers. This is a continuation of the data flow and process-driven software development, and it also introduces object-oriented design. There's talk about modular design and application consideration, and this goes into translating a DFD, data flow diagram, into pseudocode and then into actual code. The next feature is Seamanship by Clayton Walnum. This is a discussion of some AES routines that are used by common dialogues in Windows. The next feature is Ancient Corridors, Part 2, A Guide to Dungeon Master by Bob Rattel. This is a continuation of the hints for the game, and this time focusing on magic and combat. And the last feature for this issue is called Step 1 of Mice and Megabytes, Part 1, The Initial Trek by Maurice Molyneux, and this time he talks about generating computer graphics and animation and getting it onto videotape. It's an in-depth look at the process he used to generate a 10-minute animated cartoon for Epix in the promotion of Art and Film Directory at the June 1988 CES show with an adaptation to create a Star Trek scene. The last issue of ST Log is number 26, and this is from December 1988. It is 100 pages cover to cover. The ST logo is in lime green and brown this time. The backdrop is a gradient green. Santa is in front and center and holding a 2600 joystick in a rather unfortunate position. He is escaping out of an Atari monitor like a genie, and of course there is an Atari ST beneath the monitor. If you don't do anything else with this magazine, go look at the cover. The first feature here is the ST Date Planner by David Plotkin. This is an on-disk, type-in, gem-based program that will generate a calendar for any month of the year, print the calendar, and enter appointments for any day. It's written in GFA Basic. The next feature is Mouse of Fortune by Kirk Stover. This is a Wheel of Fortune game on disk, written in GFA Basic. The next feature is X-Former 2 by D. Mahaka, and this talks about updating the Atari 8-bit emulator for increased speed. There's a description of the changes and how they save cycles to make it run faster. So instead of 20% speed, it's now 40% the speed of an 8-bit. The next feature is called Step 1 of Mice and Megabytes, Part 2. This is Mice Follies by Maurice Molyneux. This is a start-to-finish detail of the creation of that Epix Art and Film Directory animated cartoon that he created for June 1988 CES show. The next feature is called Ancient Corridors Part 3, A Guide to Dungeon Master by Bob Rattel, and this time we get a non-spoiler tour of the dungeon, introduction to some of the monsters or mobs, whichever you prefer, and a look at some of the puzzles. And the last feature for this issue is Assembly Line. This is Numbers Part 2 by Douglas Weir. This time, he dives into multi-precision multiplication and multiple precision division in 68,000 Assembler. Moving on to start, we'll start with issue number 14, which is October 1988. This one is 124 pages cover to cover. The cover is a gray gradient background, and there's a profile view of a blonde man sitting in a thinker pose. In front of him, on a black Roman column, is a 1040 ST in color monitor with a solid blue screen. I hope it didn't crash. The word start is in reddish-orange letters across the top. Brain power appears in large yellow lettering just above the man. The first feature in this one is Programming Under Pressure by Tom Hudson. This is a little personal history and discussion on what it takes to be an independent software developer, including the pros and cons, as well as the 18-hour days, and a primer on how to get started. If you ever wanted to see what it's like to program underwater, take a peek. There are a couple of photos of Tom himself in scuba gear at a table underwater programming a 520 ST with a monitor on the desk as well. Don't try this at home, kids. The next article in here is software, and this is called The Vocabularian. It's included on the disc, and this is by Marathon Computer Press and John B. Holder. This lets you create vocabulary lists to learn with. It gets you started with about 160 Spanish words. And the next feature is a review, and this is of TimeWorks DTP, or Desktop Publisher, for the ST, and this is by Jerry McBride. In short, incredible. This is worth a read. The next feature is Setting Up PC Ditto by Jim Pearson Perry. If you want to get an IBM emulator up and running, here's some help. The next feature is called Getting Started, which is a primer on hard drives, part 2 by Scott Tomlin, and he covers the installation, configuration, and a little bit of usage. The next feature here is Online with Start, Prodigy, Dialogue, and the Knowledge Index by Greg Perlman. So basically, this is a comparison or review of these online services. And imagine a world where all the information you can think about is available at your fingertips. So Dialogue is a new service to me. I'd never heard of it. And this is touted as the world's largest online knowledge bank. It began as a project commissioned by the Lockheed Missiles and Space Company in the early 60s and developed specifically for NASA's Recon database. It has been available as a commercial service since 1972, and at up to $300 an hour, it is geared towards businesses and purports to have 80,000 customers worldwide. Then there is Knowledge Index, which is Dialogue's nighttime service, which has been around since the early 80s, at a much more reasonable price, $35 sign-up and 40 cents a minute. However, there are surcharges for accessing certain databases with the same normal Dialogue rates of $300 per hour. And the last feature in this issue is called Resourceful GFA Basic. This is part 3 by John Hutchinson, and this is the final installment on creating true AES dialogues with GFA Basic. The next issue of Start is number 15, and this is from November 1988. It is 109 pages cover to cover. And the cover this time is a parchment-colored background, and Start is in royal blue at the top. The picture is of a 1040 ST on a pedestal with a color monitor. The monitor has a black screen with an outline bluish Atari logo. On the left side of the pedestal is a woman dressed in business attire sitting on a stool. And on the right side of the pedestal is a woman dressed in typical 80s casual attire with bright colors and fishnet stockings, standing and holding up a Roland G707 electric guitar, which, if I recall correctly, is MIDI-enabled. And on the left side, in red lettering, it says, "The Professional ST." Under that, in a slightly smaller yellow gold color, it says, "ST, the Ultimate MIDI Machine." Presumably, these phrases reflect the two women pictured with each of their own use cases. The first feature in this one is The Professional MIDI Machine and How It Grew by Jim Pearson Perry. This is a bit of MIDI history, a bit of Atari MIDI history, and about software that's grown around it. There is a review in here, and I mention it because it's for LDW Power, and this is by Kevin Ergel. And this is just perfect. It's what I wanted to see. I try to skip through talking about reviews. However, I just learned about LDW Power during the research for this episode, and quite literally just a few days ago, so I was happy to see this review. It was benchmarked against competitors and seems like it's a top-notch program. The next feature is Setting Up PC Ditto Part 2 by David Plotkin. Hey, it's a different author this month. And there is a brief acknowledgement of the turnover of the author at the start of the article. And this one, it continues with drive configuration and boot files. The next feature is Take Care of Your ST by Andrew Reese. This is essentially common sense instructions for keeping the ST in top shape. The next feature is Programming in Basic, Starts Putmaker by A.L. Hubbard. I wonder if there's any relation to Ron Hubbard. The program is on the disk, and it helps you add graphics and title screens to GFA basic programs, and it can convert Neochrome and Degas files into basic code. The last feature for this issue is Online with Start, and this is Lotus and DBase files for your ST by Greg Perlman. And this is information on where to get Lotus 1-2-3 templates and DBase 3 Plus forms for use in Atari programs that support those formats, like LDW Power, VIP Pro, and DBMan. The last issue for Start is number 16, and this is December of 1988. It is 108 pages cover to cover. The cover has a white background with red Start lettering. In large blue letters on the left, it says Hot ST Hardware. Pictured is a Viking Moniterm monitor sitting atop an Atari Mega ST4 with the detached keyboard and mouse sitting in front. On the monitor is a fighter jet done in CAD. Around and on it are miniature people all looking at the screen with some of them pointing at it. The first feature here is a look at PC Utilities by David Plotkin. And this talks about running TSR, or Terminate and Stay Resident, programs under PC Ditto. And this mentions command tips by Intersoft Publishing International and Norton Advanced Utilities by Norton. The next one is a program, and this is Santa BBS by Albert Baguette. This is a simulated BBS program that lets your kids, quote-unquote, dial into Santa's BBS. This lets kids tell Santa exactly what they want and find out if they deserve it. It simulates dialing and connect and a busy. It also simulates the bulletin board functions like a number guessing game, stories, surveys, sending and receiving messages to Santa. I wish I'd known about this 6 years ago. It would have been fun to use with my son. The next feature is Hard Disk Lore and First Aid Part 1 by David Small. And this is all about your hard drive, what it is, how it works, and how it's set up physically and logically. The next feature is called Programming in Basic. This time it's a 2-for-1. There are Generalized Input Routines by Michael E. Heppner and GFA Menu Builder by David Plotkin. The input routines let you set up gem menu bars and option list screens, I think input forms, and the Menu Builder is a GUI-based menu designer that writes the back-end menu code for you. I'm going to mention an ad this time, and I only mention it because I recall one of my friends having this and several others in the community talking about it quite a bit. This is on page 70, and it's by Practical Solutions, and it's called Tweety Board. It's a solderless add-on board that provides crystal clear, true stereo 3D sound and is only $49.95. And the last feature for this magazine is called Online with Start. And it's What to Look For in a Modem by Greg Perlman. I know, RS-232 connectivity and Wi-Fi, am I right? Nope, not quite in 1988. This discusses types of modems and speed, then goes on to compare a few, including the Atari SX-212. And I would talk about Atari Explorer, but there are none until the first quarter of 1989. All right, the last issue I'm going to cover is ST Amiga Format, and this is number 4 from October of 1988. This one is 108 pages, cover to cover. On the cover is a digitized photo of a man giving you an evil eye. But it's not just digitized. It has psychedelic colors applied to it. And so it kind of looks cybery, if that's a word. Captioned in large white text, it says, "Grabbed." Then with smaller white text underneath, it says, "Put yourself in the picture with a video digitizer." The first feature is called Comms, Riding the Wires by Mark Higgum. This is an introduction to online communications with an overview of hardware and software required, as well as types of online services and lingo. This lists a few BBSs from the UK, if you're willing to throw caution to your phone bill and to the wind. The next feature here is Programming, and this is True Basic by Richard Monteiro. This is more or less a review of True Basic with some background on the language, an overview of the features, and comparison of the Amiga and ST versions, and some benchmarks thrown in as well. And it looks like True Basic and GFA are right about the same performance. And if I recall correctly, True Basic is still around today in some form. The next feature is a music feature. It's Ready MIDI Go by Chris Jenkins. And this is what to do next once you've gone down the MIDI path and bought a MIDI keyboard or drums or guitar or whatever. This tells you how to set up a MIDI studio, what all the parts involved are, keyboards that you can get for cheap, etc. The next feature is Graphics, and this is Digitizers by Richard Monteiro and Jason Holborn. This asks the question, what is a digitizer and how do they work? This will give you all the info you need, including some mini software reviews and some sample full-color images. The next feature is Programming. This is Learn Basic by Richard Monteiro. This is a look at conditions and different looping constructs. And there are two tips sections, one for the Atari and one for the Commodore. The next issue of ST Amiga Format is number 5. This is from November of 1988. It is 100 pages cover to cover. The cover backdrop is a half-tone gray. There is a cartoon man on the cover as well. He is peering out from the right side and wearing a blue shirt. He has glasses and an almost monobrow. He looks angry and his mouth is open, which I take to be him yelling. On the left side in large blue lettering, it says Cartoon Capers. In smaller black letters underneath it, it says All You Need to Know to Create Your Own Superhero. The first feature in here is News. And I was browsing through this section and I noticed that database software is bringing MiniOffice 2 to the ST. And rather than a single low price for the entire suite, they are charging per module, bringing the total to £150. I reviewed MiniOffice 2 for the Atari 8-bit on Inversitaski, Season 4, Episode 9, and there's a link in the show note. The next feature is called Futures, Pixel Punchers by Richard Monteiro, and this is a look at the rapid pace of graphics capabilities and the computers that create works of pixel art. He lists some of the use cases as video titling, animation, scientific research, CAD, and desktop publishing. What about crypto mining? You can't even buy a video card now. So good luck finding a good graphics card for a reasonable price these days. He also discusses techniques used to create the art like wireframes, 3D object primitives, and ray tracing. The next feature is Boost Your ST by Richard Monteiro. This is an overview of the Blitter installation now that the chips are showing up, what the Blitter chip does, and what kind of performance to expect. It also compares it with the software product Turbo ST, and as it turns out, Turbo ST is faster than the Blitter for a few operations, but Blitter is overall faster with an average increase of 20%. Where Turbo ST shines is in character printing to the screen with an average increase of 31%. The next feature is called STPD by Richard Monteiro. This is a rundown of some useful public domain software. And I mention that as there's an explanation of what FSEL is. I noticed several pieces of software I have include it, and it's an improved file selector that only takes 20K of memory. It looks like I also need to get Superboot 2, which allows for selecting which accessories to load, which desktop to load, and can display pictures on boot. The next feature is called Funny Business by Ian Bennett. and this is a 10-step tips and tricks guide to becoming an electronic cartoon artist. The last feature we'll cover is Learn Basic by Simon Williams, and this article explains basics, different data structures, and variable types. It discusses Amiga Basic and Power Basic, and there are some demo programs on the disk that can be loaded up into ST Basic with modification. And I guess if you have a portfolio with Power Basic, you could just use those directly. And the last issue for ST Amiga format and for this episode is ST Amiga format number 6, which is December of 1988. And this one is 116 pages cover to cover. The cover backdrop is a screen scrape of something similar to Winamp, and it looks to be a CD player with a waveform underneath. Superimposed in translucent gray is the silhouette of a person playing a trombone, and emblazoned in large white text is the call-out, Sound Judgment. In smaller white text beneath, it reads, Making Music Easy, 6 Samplers Tested. The first feature is called Futures Inside Info by Mark Evans. This takes a look at the Amiga and ST operating systems and user interfaces with a little bit of history thrown in. Not knowing much about the Amiga, I now understand what Kickstart, Intuition, and Workbench are on that platform, and there is a glimpse into the future with multitasking and alternative operating systems and this thing called Unix that everybody's talking about, and some insight into the next versions of TOS, GEM, and Workbench. Add another 15 or so years, and Linux will be the next big thing. The next feature is a music feature called Sample City by Richard Monteiro, and this is more or less a review of the most recent video digitizers and sound samplers mixed between the ST and Amiga platforms. The next feature is another music feature, and it's called AI AIO by Chris Jenkins. And this looks at making music on your ST, including software that has artificial intelligence built into it to help you out. And there are some micro reviews of several pieces of software here. There's a review in here called Battle Chess versus Colossus Chess X. And I mention this for Pete's sake. This is a review and a comparison of both games, with Colossus just edging out Battle Chess. They didn't compare battling other computers, and perhaps that would push Battle Chess to the top. Next, there's an interview called 8 into 16, and this is an interview with Codemasters duo Richard Darling and Bruce Everiss. In here, there's a focus on why they have been slow to make 16-bit games since they were so successful with the 8-bits. And hey, free mention for Steve Jobs' next computers included. And ultimately, they are concerned about Atari's poor U.S. sales. That's the bottom line. The next feature is called Learn Basic by Simon Williams, but he's uncredited. And this is part 5 of the series. This time he dives into file handling, so you can learn all about random and sequential access and the commands that make it happen. And there are samples again in Power Basic, and the good news is these should also work on your Atari portfolio without any issues. And the last section we'll talk about is called Tips. And in this section, there is a user submission called Stealing Sound Samples. It tells you to grab the speech.dat file from the game Xenon, rename it to speech.prg, then run it and follow the prompts. This will cause the computer to play the speech Sector 1, Sector 2, Sector 3, Sector 4, which are samples played at the beginning of each game level. Hackers, am I right? Let's see. Let's just rename this file and see what happens. Who knew? In this last issue, I noticed the term WIMP, W-I-M-P, is used a lot in reference to the Amiga and the ST. Presumably, it's the user interface. I've never heard this before and had to look it up. It stands for Window, Icon, Menu, and Pointer, and references the new paradigm in user interfaces. I had always referred to them as GUIs, or graphical user interfaces. So maybe WIMP was a UK thing. Also, one thing I noticed with ST Amiga format is the volume of content. There is quite a bit in each one, and most of it is software reviews. So I'm not going to complain about it too much. The only real complaint I have about the magazine is that it's the mixed platform. I get that Amiga and the ST are direct competitors and somewhat similar, but some articles are not applicable to the ST, so I sometimes find myself a page into it before realizing there's no point in continuing. I know later on they break the ST portion into its own magazine, so that feeling will likely change. And on the plus side, they include a lot of screenshots. I mean a lot of screenshots. Product photos, and where applicable, output examples. And one last comment about the format magazines. I gotta say, I'm a little jealous at the Amiga's user interface. It looks all grown up and more user-friendly. Having never used an Amiga, I can't say for sure. I just think it makes Jim Desktop look a little archaic in contrast. There are links to all the magazine PDFs in the show notes, and most of these are available from Atari Mania. ST Format also has its own dedicated shrine as well.
Picks.
Okay, for hardware, I scoured the magazines quite a bit before settling on a hardware pick. I finally ended up with something new. This time, I pick a new Super product, the SuperDrive FD10, which is a 10 megabyte removable floppy. It has an 80 millisecond average access time. It can also read IBM 360K and 1.2 megabyte 5.25 inch disks. It includes a battery-backed real-time clock, and it connects to the ST's DMA port. The case is similar to their other hard drives, with the lower front panel being a drive loader mechanism. The storage media is a specially formatted quad-density floppy that can hold 10 megabytes. At first I thought this might be like an iOmega Bernoulli drive, but I don't think that it is. Super provides software that tricks Jim into allowing the non-floppy floppy to be swapped out because that is normally only allowable for A and B floppy drives. And this is in essence a hard drive, how it's connected. So I couldn't find a whole lot of information on it, but it is a pretty cool idea. The only downside is the price at $895, which is $2,020 today. Whoa. And blank media costs $39.95 each. Each blank disk holds the equivalent of 14 double-sided 3.5-inch floppy disks. And all the information I did find is linked in the show notes. I wonder how prevalent these were out in the field. For software, I picked LDW Power. This spreadsheet has a maximum size cell extent of 256 by 8,192. You can create presentation graphics and print them. It includes macros and can simultaneously operate on up to four windows at once. It includes a 232-page comprehensive manual, and after tracking a copy down, I created a sample spreadsheet for a mock budget, and this was actually quite easy to use. It was fast enough, and although scrolling many rows could be a bit quicker, nonetheless, that's probably a Jim issue, and it was quicker than Kuma Spreadsheet and VIP Pro, which I also did the same exercise with. The interface was quite welcoming as well and very easy to use, and it did indeed follow the Lotus menu structure for the most part, and at least most of the Lotus commands I remember anyway. The graphs were easy to generate as well and looked pretty darn good. I guess enough with the mini review and cut it short. LDW Power has earned a permanent spot on my ST's hard drive. For the application this time, I had a tough time trying to figure out what I wanted to cover, and since I talked about modems, I thought I'd talk about the telephone jack connectors. So when I was looking at the modems and it started referencing the different connector types, this started raising some questions in my head. I always thought that the phone line connections, at least in the US, were RJ12. What is the difference between RJ12, RJ11, RJ13, and the W and C variants described in the modem's compatibilities? Well, let's start here. RJ stands for registered jack. The 11, 12, and 13 types are the same housing. They all have six positions for conductor wires. They provided a bridge connection of the tip and ring conductors of the telephone line. When looking at the housing head on, with the latch on the bottom, the positions increase from numbers 1 to 6 from left to right. Typically, ring is in position 3 and tip is in position 4. So what are the C and W variants? W is simply for wall mount devices, and C is for surface mount or flush mount devices, or essentially everything that's not wall mount. And when we talk about surface mount, we're talking about those baseboard boxes that were prevalent in homes in the 80s. Okay, so now let's look at the differences. So RJ11, this uses only the innermost two wires, tip and ring, and it's typically used on single line sets or data equipment that operate at -9 dBm. RJ12 uses four lines and is typically used with one line of a key telephone system. It provides a bridge connection of tip and ring of the telephone line, as well as a bridge connection of the A and A1 lines of the key telephone system, which are positions 2 and 5 respectively. Tip and ring lines are connected ahead of the key telephone system line circuit. Typical use is when the device requires a PBX or central office ringing. RJ13 uses four wires as well, and in the same configuration as RJ12, and is also typically used with one line of a key telephone system. It provides an electrically bridged connection of tip and ring behind the key telephone circuit, and a bridge connection to A and A1 lines of the key telephone system. Typical use is when the device does not need PBX or central office ringing to operate. These are subtle differences, mainly for the intended application. I know in the past I used plenty of four-conductor RJ12 cables on single phone line systems, which, as I've just learned, is RJ11 spec. There are also seven other variants for this six-position housing, 14C and W, 16X, 17C, 18C, 19C, and 25C. There's a link in the show notes to an 85-page Bell document describing all the jacks and their variants.
Feedback.
So I don't have any feedback this time. Nobody knew I was coming back. And to encourage some feedback in the future, or even some user submissions, here's what will be in the next episode. The time frame will be from January 1989 through March of 1989. If you have something you want to share, email it, post it on Facebook, or submit an audio submission, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thanks.
So I want to thank Factor 6 for the music used throughout. It's from a track called Generalist with the ST in capitals. There's a link to it and from other music from Factor 6, not in the show notes, but on the website at inversetaski.info. Check out his other work. Also, I'd like to thank all of you for listening and for your patience and the length of time it takes to get these episodes out. And hopefully there'll be more than just these next three episodes. Thanks, everyone.
Goodbye.